And tonight on Coast to Coast AM, we'll talk about the Book of Revelation and how does that affect all of us. We go live down under to Australia in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie, and we're going to talk about the Book of Revelation. I think we're having some line problems down under in Australia. So I'm going to give you the numbers. We may have to do a little bit of open lines here for a while until we get MG Michael back on the line. It seems like they are frozen stiff down in Australia. West of the Rockies? Oh, we got him. He's back. There you go, MG. You with us?
Is that George?
Yes, good to have you. Well, let me do your little introduction here got your phone line going. MG Michael is an honorary associate professor, School of Information Systems and Technology at the University of, I'm going to have you pronounce that university, MG.
Of Wollongong.
Wollongong. And that's in Australia, of course. And Michael is a theologian and historian with disciplinary qualifications in humanities. We're going to talk about humanity, the Book of Revelation and everything. But tell us a little bit more about you, Mike.
Well, George, it's a pleasure to be here. A very good morning to you and to your listeners.
Well, thank you.
One way or another, I've been engaging with the Book of Revelation for over 30 years. And to begin with, as a young man in my late teens into my early 20s. And it was a period where my reading of the book was rather crude and literal. So at the time, I essentially understood the revelation very much in terms of prophecy. And it was quite visceral and sensory. So the next period, where I began to understand a little more of the book's tremendous significance, and I started to look for its influence in the secular world, but also to explore it deeper as an enduring testimony of the strength and power of the human spirit against all sorts of adversity and as an indication of the love of God. That was an important time in my life. And up to that stage, I was intrigued by the prophetic element, but then I started upon the most fulfilling and rewarding period of my engagement with the apocalypse. And this brings us down to the present day, George. It was during those years from my early 30s, I traveled extensively to find monastics and other religious people who had reflected upon the book in prayerful solitude, and I spent time with them. But the great thing was that parallel to these journeys, I started upon my own critical studies of the book, which would culminate in two dissertations under the supervision of some really special teachers. But both of these exercises proved fascinating, but at times they were extremely challenging. So my humanities involved studies in theology and philosophy, politics, but theology was, for me, the essential element doing.
That was many cultures and civilizations, MG, since the beginning of mankind, have always felt that they were in end times. They were in the apocalypse. And it's probably no different now. Why did they all feel that way? Because we haven't really had it yet. And maybe we're in it now. Who knows? But why did all these past civilizations always feel as if they were in end times?
Well, I think that's something which is inherited to our nature. We always feel that the end times are upon us because it's very much connected to our own mortality. And so it's a natural inclination to look at history as having a sudden ending, their own lives come to a sudden end. Usually a crisis in a culture, in a history, a war, a disease, a plague, would invoke this sort of sentiment. And nowadays, of course, we've got the new technologies with their close association to the revelation, and that gives us our feeling of these imminent times. So each culture, each time, has its own particular story, a particular understanding of where it is in context to the end of the world. And that's why I've always considered that the apocalypse is a form of literature.
Yeah.
Is a universal genre. I continue to be fascinated by it. The word itself comes from revelation, which is from the Greek word, which means an unveiling of things not previously known before. And this fascinates people. What is there that we don't know? And I think that is the crux of it, George, the element of mortality, the fact that catastrophic events would suggest that there is an end. And there's always been floods and earthquakes and natural disasters. But today in particular, I think, the element of technology plays an important part with some sort of predictions that we can associate with Revelation, and particularly Revelation 13.
When they talk about, the second coming, are they talking about something that will be just so mystical that the entire planet will realize this? Or is it something different? Like, maybe this person may end up being the head of a country or the president of the United States, and it kind of happens that way.
Well, if we're talking about the second coming of Jesus, this is something that all the world will see, and we prepare for it. If we're talking about the Antichrist, as Christians understand it, there will be a preparation. There will be signs, and these signs are told to us and expressed to us by Christ, whether in the Gospel of Matthew or whether it's in the Apocalypse. And this is a reason why the Apocalypse has fascinated me, as an indication of these signs. So when it comes to Christ, it will come as a sudden, as a thief in the night. We will all see it. But there will be signs which will preempt it. And same for the Antichrist. There will be signs which will preempt his coming. So there will be a real aspect and a real essence to these events. They won't just happen out of the blue. They won't be just something that will be in idealized form. And I found these questions fascinating. And that's why as a young man, I wanted to understand more of what they meant, how they were to be understood. And I began to immerse myself in the study of the Apocalypse. And it's a book that continues to fascinate me to this present moment.
Yeah.
And can I say one more thing about that, George?
Absolutely. Sure thing.
Because I've given my life to this book. Well, often, the Apocalypse, as I said, is from the Greek, which means revelation. It's an unveiling of things. But it's not a cataclysm. Apocalypse doesn't mean catastrophe. And that's something which came to me later in my studies as I began to see the positive messages of the book. And also, we should never call it the Book of Revelations. It was never that. It was one revelation. And that revelation was given to John by Jesus Christ himself, who received it from God the Father. So the correct title to the text are indeed the very opening words of the book, the revelation of or from Jesus Christ. And in fact, there are some versions of the New Testament that the title of the book is given exactly that, the revelation of Jesus Christ. And this is an important distinction to remember. Also, the fact that Apocalypse were delivered by heavenly messengers. And so, going back to these questions, there are signs, there are indications, there is a testimony. Nothing will happen out of the blue. There are documents that we have received. Of course, I'm speaking as a member of the Christian community.
Sure.
So, back to the Apocalypse, if I could. The Apocalypse is a genre of prophetical writings, and it has to do with the end times. And your question was very important. Why did those Christians back then think it was the end times? There was persecution by Nero, by Domitian.
Mm-hmm.
So these people thought the whole world was coming to an end.
That's right. For
and
them.
So, exactly. And the Apocalypse was written at a time where they thought it was all going to finish. There was going to be death, and there was going to be a loss of great life and suffering. And so this suffering had to be redeemed. So Apocalypse also gives the message of redemption. And it's exactly why this literature was especially popular in Judaic and Christian in the Christian world from about 200 BC to 200 AD during exiles and persecutions. And it's specifically characterized by visions, imagery, symbolic numerology, and back to what we were saying, good versus evil. So this kind of literature offered hope. And in the face of an ongoing persecution or a severe crisis, it encouraged steadfastness and faith. And so it was precisely under these kinds of circumstances that the revelation was written by the seer of Patmos, the feeling of the end times, the feeling that this small community of Christians was going to be extinguished and there had to be a redemption. And so the summary of its message or its ultimate purpose of the Apocalypse is the end of human history. And in particular, it's the culmination of history in the kingdom of the Messiah and Jesus Christ, who's the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. And so this is the sort of literature, the kind of understanding that we find in apocalyptic writings, and in the feelings and expressions of people who believe that their time upon the earth as a history, as a civilization, is about to come to an end. It's a sign that they believe there will be a great battle of good versus evil, and normally natural disasters will preempt this, or with the persecutions, and it's this feeling that comes with every generation. But as I said, we're living in quite extraordinary times, where the Book of Revelation has become deeply important.
Well, when you mentioned Revelation 13, I believe, and that talked about a beast coming out of the sea. A lot of this, MG, is for interpretation, of course. But how do you interpret something like this, who talks about, you know, all these different heads on this monster?
Yes. These are all symbols of apocalyptic imagery. And they are very much part of the apocalyptic motifs. Beasts represent powers, normally wicked. They represent wicked powers, threats to humankind. They are motifs that are popular with the writers of the apocalypse, and we find it also in the Book of Daniel. So one of the fascinating aspects of the beast, one of the mark of the beast in Revelation 13:16, if I could read it.
Yeah, and then let's explain it so people understand.
Yeah. So we're talking about Revelation 13:16. He causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads. Okay, and normally when we speak of the beast of the apocalypse, this is where people are fascinated, and it grabs our attention.
It sure does. And pick up 17 and 18, too, if you would.
Okay, now, Revelation 17 and 18 is, well, now, I want to do that through memory, and that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. Now, here is wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. Now, this is a number that has fascinated myriads of people.
Yeah, it drives people crazy, MG.
Yeah, it does, and it shouldn't, because it drove people crazy, George, even back in the early years when the book was written. And in fact, by the second century, people had actually forgotten to whom the number was actually attributed to. So it's fascinated people and confused people for a long time. But what remained, I'll speak more about it here, but what remained central, what remained significant to the mark was what it represented, what it signified. It wasn't that important to whom or to what it was pointing, but what it signified.
Yeah.
And what it signified was the epitome of all wickedness, of all evil. It was a recapitulation of all unrighteousness.
All right, now let me ask you this as let me take the outside position for a moment. So under 16, we're to receive a mark in our hand or our foreheads.
Yep.
And to me, that sounds like either some kind of microchip or something that we would use for commerce. Now, on the face of it, and I'm not going to get chipped, but on the face of it, let me be the devil's advocate if I can. I don't know how close we are to that, too. But on the face of it, what's wrong with receiving a microchip in your hand for buying things, goods, and services? Yet it's tied into something very evil. So there's something I'm missing.
Well, that is the question, isn't it? And the important thing is that, and I'll speak more about it. I will give you some detail, because this is a very important question, and it concerns a lot of the book's story and history. See, we're sealed by God. We are His. And in by allowing, look, if it's a microchip or an RFID tattoo or an implantable, we don't know, George.
We don't.
I avoid getting too much, drilling too deep into this, because technology, as you know, better than most, it can change overnight.
Right. But it's something. Because this is clearly very direct.
Exactly. Yeah. It's an indication. If we allow this karagma, the mark, and I'll explain what it is in a moment, it's a sign of allegiance that we've given ourselves over to the powers who are anti-God, that we're giving ourselves to a principality that is wicked.
Okay.
So there is this battle for our spirits, for our souls, and we either keep our forehead for the seal of God, which is also in the Apocalypse, in chapter 7. So there is a parody, there's a parallel. So on our foreheads will be written the name of God. If we give that over, we align ourselves to the powers, the demonic powers that seek to usurp his kingdom and take us into their realm. So it's a matter of allegiance. It's a matter of ownership. It's a matter of witnessing and saying, my body, my allegiance is to God. It's to the Holy Trinity. And I will not give it over through a microchip or any sort of technology which may be associated with the buying and the selling.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a context, and I'll make this a bit clearer. So what's important, George, is to know what the mark actually is. Would you agree?
I would agree. When I was younger, you know, going through my Catholic catechism classes, I thought, MG, that maybe the mark of the beast might have been our social security numbers.
Yes. Well, as we go through,
as
technology evolves, and there are different technologies which can be associated with it, whether it's an ID security number, whether it's biometrics, whether it's some sort of tattoo. And this is why we have to be very sober, and we wait, not for one individual, but for a collective, a Christian consciousness, the church community, together one day will rise up and we will speak. There won't be one man speaking up. So when this arrives, there will be a singularity of our voices, as difficult as it may be to believe here, but this is what we're told, and this is what we believe. So it's useful to know that the Greek for what we normally translate mark is karagma. Now, this was a technical term for the imperial stamp on documents, but it also stood for the emperor's head that was stamped on coins, okay? So the karagma or mark represented the likeness or the name of the emperor, but it could also mean a brand. And here, we're looking at your question more deeply. So, slaves could be branded with marks of ownership, and devotees could label themselves by a brand or a mark as belonging to a particular deity or a pagan cult, as might soldiers with the name of a favorite general. So to put it simply, and going back to this question of what it means, so to put it simply, to be marked or branded would indicate some sort of ownership or allegiance. Now, that's the context of the passage in the Apocalypse, and that's why I want to go there. So if we get branded or marked, it means that we've given over ownership of our bodies and spirits, and we've aligned ourselves to this anti-kingdom of God. So there is here also, as I said, the idea of a parallel, okay, with the seal of the living God. And we find that in Revelation 7:2 and 14:1. Should I read that for you?
Real quick, yeah.
Yeah, very quick. It's Revelation 7:2. I think it'll be a lovely parallel. Okay. After these things, I saw another angel ascending from the east, having the seal of the living God, and he cried with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was granted to harm the earth and the sea. So there is a choice to be made. So the seal of God is not called karagma. It's called a sragis, and it's stamped on the foreheads of his servants and marks out people belonging to him. So the mark of the beast similarly identifies individuals as his servants, people that belong to him, who have become his property. So there are eternal consequences for both groups of people, according to which camp they align themselves. Again, there is the theme of trade-offs in this literature. So the ones who are sealed by God will be protected from the plagues that will devastate the earth. Yet those with the mark will be the only ones who would be able to buy or to sell. So, but also note the universality of those who are marked. They are small and great. They are rich and poor. They are free and slave. It's also important to note that God's mark or seal is invisible. It points to a spiritual reality, and the body is not violated. So given the pagan parallels and the clear references to the requirements of commerce, the mark of the beast would appear to be visible and not a card.
Hold on for 1 second, MG. We'll be back with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back with MG Michael here as we talk about the book of Revelation. Michael, in these various verses and in the various revelation, why were they like writing in parables? Why didn't they just spell it right out?
Okay. Well, George, I've noted down all your questions, and I'm going to get to them. These are very important questions because apocalypticism, it was specific to a genre. They were dealing with issues that were very difficult to describe in ordinary terms. And sometimes there was material that was written precisely against a powerful system or a government or against the Roman Empire or an emperor. So it had to be cryptographic. They couldn't go right out and mention names or governments. It was more of it was self-protection as well. And the apocalypse, of course, makes a great note of that when it speaks of 666. It's hiding the beast that it's referring to, but it makes it quite clear that the early communities knew who the beast was. So it's more self-protection, and also it was part of the apocalyptic genre, that it dealt in these sort of mystical ways of presenting realities, of trying to describe realities that couldn't be described in normal everyday language. I mean, how do you describe heaven? How do you describe God? How do you describe salvation and judgment? You've got to look at poetic forms. It can't happen any other way. And the apocalypse was, in a sense, a great poetic form. And I've noted down all these questions, and I'm going to get to them. And I'll give you an idea of who the early church thought 666 was. And I'll also speak to you more of the modern technologies. How does that
sound? Sure, sure.
Is that okay?
Yep.
Okay, so we were talking about the mark of the beast and its number. Now, the mark of the beast, the 666 refers to the first beast. Now, why is that important? Because the first beast represents political power. It's the one arising from the sea. There are two beasts. Now, the second beast comes out of the earth, and that represents false religion. Mm. And its job is to bring honor and glory to the first. So the religious element brings power, glory, and authority and credibility to the political element. So if we have to speak of Antichrist in this context for the apocalypse, amazingly, does not use the term. It would be in reference to the first beast rising up out of the sea. Now, also of special interest is while the fourth beast of Daniel 7 is diverse from all the other beasts that were before it, the first beast of Revelation 13 has characteristics of all four of Daniel 7 beasts. It has the mouth of a lion, again, the poetic language, okay, the feet of a bear, and is like a leopard. And it has 10 horns, just the fourth beast of Daniel 7 has 10 horns. So this is the epitome of a worldly kingdom opposed to God and his kingdom. So the actual term Antichrist, George, is mentioned only in the Johannine epistles, where he's described as appearing in the end times. Who is the Antichrist? He is a liar and the one who denies the Father and the Son. Now, this character is also connected to Paul's infamous man of lawlessness or man of sin from 2 Thessalonians 2:1-12, whose coming is according to the working of Satan. And he will be with all power, signs, and lying wonders. So this is very important. I can't speak enough of how important the context and the history and the understanding of what gave rise to an apocalyptic genre. It's essential that we may understand the text. We just can't jump into the book and talk about 666 and talk about technologies without understanding what the literature is all about. It's the literature itself which gives us hints. And if we could comprehend the symbols, if we could comprehend the metaphors, then we're able to give some sort of sober discussion on what 66 is, on what it may be, mm-hmm. on what it meant. And I can't escape that. And sometimes, you know, people press me to get right into the 666 and to get right into the apocalyptic motifs. But I can't do that. It's impossible for me. I've studied the book for too long. And I have to emphasize, and I'm so glad we're doing it tonight, and you're letting me do it, which is great, that we have to understand how this literature was born, why it was born, and the reason for its being. So the language has to be poetic. It can't describe the realities of the other world in any other way. And so the next question, I suppose, is, if you want me to address it now, is the 666?
And is it frightening the more you learn about it?
Me, George?
You personally, yeah.
You know, that's quite possibly the most difficult question you've asked me, and you've caught me unprepared for that. It's really personal, isn't it? And I'm really glad you have. I really do embrace you for that. It gives meaning to all this, George, because So to me personally, okay, I gave you the short version of my introduction to the book.
Right.
That happened in my late teens. But the long version begins when I was 8. I'm not going to go there. But I was introduced to the book of Revelation in one way or another when I was 8. And then I was reintroduced back to it again in my late teens. So I've had a long history with it. And in the beginning, as I mentioned, yes, it scared me. When I first got to the book, it scared me because I understood it alone as a prophecy. I read about the beasts, which you have very well brought up, and I thought, what are these monsters? What does it mean? I read about dragons and trumpets and plagues. I read about the Battle of Armageddon and the Harlot of Babylon, marks of the beast, and couldn't buy a cell, and I was caught up in the prophecy, and it scared me. But then when I began to read it, and I saw when I began to look at the context, and I saw the liturgical element, I saw the great praise of God, I saw the victory of the Lamb, I saw the confidence and the inspiration and the lessons of conquering that it gave to people. It gave them hope. I began to see another aspect of the book, and that was its prophetic element, because prophecy is not only predictive. It can be prophecy can be a lesson. It could be pastoral. So I saw these wonderful lessons. I saw these wonderful inspirations that said to me, look, there is a dark side to history. There is Stalin, and there is Hitler. And there are all these small apocalypses going on throughout the world. But they need not be the end. There is something else which comes. And that's why people who have come through that sort of life haven't given up and have written wonderful biographies of salvation coming through that fire. Biographies of people who have survived concentration camps and wars, and they found a revelation. So the apocalypse in my second reading gave me hope. It taught me that there is light to the apocalypse and that there is a joy in the conquering, and that if only I would keep steadfast, if I would endure, if I wouldn't give up hope, then not only would revelation come to me in some way or another, but I would find answers, and I would have to focus on the liturgical element. And something, George, which people don't really know, you know, the genre of the apocalypse. I talk about prophecy and apocalypse. So prophecy talks about the end times, talks about things that will happen. But there's all, it spoke about apocalypse and its particular style of writing. But the apocalypse is also a letter. That's the important thing. It was a letter originally addressed to the seven churches in Asia Minor. That was intimate. It was an epistle. So you begin to see it as a letter addressed to you and addressed to the broader church. And you begin to see the admonitions and the counseling that are given to those churches. And you learn from that. You listen to it. And you derive strength. And you know, yes, I will suffer. Yes, I may fall. Yes, I may fall into transgression. But there is hope. I myself as an individual can live my own little apocalypse. So it's also an individual lesson. We must suffer our own apocalypse. We must suffer our own small judgments. But there is a conquering. And all we have to do is remain steadfast. Do not let any temporal dark power, whether it's corporate state or personal, take away hope. The apocalypse I was discovering year by year as I was studying the book was essentially a lesson of hope, that God is in control. And all these beasts and all these adversaries, they're not anti-gods. See, Hollywood's given us this idea of one God, one great Satan. Satan is not an anti-God. He's a fallen creature. He's a fallen angel. So these creatures want to become like God, but they cannot become like God. And in the apocalypse, they want to give us the idea. And why? To deceive us, to believe that they are gods, but they're not. So God is without an enemy, but he has adversaries. So I began to see that. I began to see how there will come an end to history. One way or another, whether it was in my time, it didn't matter. It's none of my business when the world will end. But it's my business to make sure that when I personally sit before the judgment seat of Christ, that I have a good conscience,
yeah,
that I have tried to live a life that is good. Maybe not the perfect life, but a life that is good.
At least prepared. Yeah.
Yes. So the book became personal. Despite its, of course, its universal charter, it's a universal book, and it's all about the culmination of history and the Lamb triumphs and God redeems, and there is an end, and then we move on to the other realms, and there is a judgment, of course. So I began to see these things, and as I got into the third stage, where I began to, as a scholar, I've written two dissertations on the book. And then I began to see this. Oh, how can I explain it? This profound richness, this terrible awesomeness of the text. And it became imperative for me to investigate this devastating vastness, but also to remind myself to pause and to think that I am myself living in extraordinary times. And never to forget that truly there is a God who exists and who acts in the world. So that's the third stage, and I traveled the world. I lived with monastics and on Athos and in the Sinai, in the Kidron Valley.
God, you've seen so many different cultures and civilizations.
I had to because when I began to understand that the revelation was not something that was written in isolation. It was something that was written in a great community and in a great upheaval. And I was going to say, George, that what people don't realize that the book has strong elements, overwhelming elements of liturgy. It's surprising, it might shock you. A lot of it is a song. And many of its elements were actually, chanted and sung in psalms in the early church, all the great holy, holy, holies, and the hymns addressed to Jesus. It's a book of song as well. And when I saw these things, and when I saw how it also encouraged these people who are living by themselves in cloisters or in the desert, and they found comfort by its message. Not isolation, but solitude. And solitude is an entirely different thing. And sometimes we may be drawn to solitude, but it's not a beastly isolation. It's one in communion with the saints.
Do you think, Andrew, that we are in Revelation now?
Okay, well, I'll get to that in a minute. I've noted that question down too. I'm going to talk about this after I say Genesis 6:6, can I?
Yeah.
Is it okay, George?
Yeah.
Okay. You stop me when you want to stop me, because I think we're getting to the crux of the book. Most people come to Revelation because they hear 666 and they think, what is that?
Right.
Who is it? What is it? Is it an RFP? Is it a biometric? Was it Hitler? Was it Napoleon? You know, was it Ronald Wilson Reagan?
Right. I mean, was it George Bush? You know?
Was it George Bush? I mean, it is incredible. It's quite ridiculous, and it depresses me when I hear those things. But this thing is not new to our times. It was happening in the 3rd and 4th centuries, all these names that were given. So in a minute, I will tell you the one probable name. And I hope this enlightens our listeners who may not know this. There is one name that is connected to 666 that is possibly what it's about. And we'll discuss what it may teach us. So let's look at the mark. And the mark is in Revelation 13:17, okay? And it's described as the name of the beast or the number of his name. So immediately following, now I've got to try and get this right.
I mean, and what baffles me too is the specifics of saying either in the forehead or in the right hand. Well, I mean, it's amazing.
I'll get to that too. Oh boy, you've read the apocalypse.
Of course.
I'll get to that. You're just giving me so much excitement and joy here. I'm all over the place.
it's my job to rein you in, MG. So
thank you. You've got to rein me in, especially that time in the morning. I don't want to bring in the closets out of the skeleton. Skeletons out of the closet.
What time is it in Australia, by the way? It's Monday already over there.
Yeah, we're about afternoon. 10 to 8. 10 to 8 in the evening.
In the evening, that's right. You're going into Tuesday pretty soon.
Yeah. I haven't slept. I've had a lot of work.
This is like time traveling. You can tell me what happened on Tuesday, and I'll be a day ahead of everybody.
Yeah, but it's good. Now, immediately following verse 18, John tells us that it represents the name of a man, that is a human number, and that his number is 666. Though I've got to tell you, there are some ancient manuscripts that give it a 616, but I spent many years looking at that, and there's little doubt that 666 is correct. The 616 only gives credence to who the beast is because it supports the reading of 666. I'll explain that in a minute. So this identification of a name with a number is not new to John. Okay. In Greek, but also in Hebrew, numbers were indicated by the letters of the alphabet. So in English, we might say A equals 1, B equals 2, C equals 3, and so on.
Good point.
Yeah. Are you finding this interesting?
Yep.
Okay. And so the identification of a name with a number was made possible. And it is not unique to the apocalypse of John, I mean. So in this instance, we have the Greek characters, and originally they were originally in capital script, not an Arabic numeral, okay, which adds to give a 666. So this is significant in itself to know that 666 does not appear in Arabic numerals, and this makes a great deal of difference to how serious students of these verses and the Christian community understands how this number might be applied. Because you know how Hollywood has all these movies.
Oh, Hollywood
does. You
see
the number on heads and foreheads and all these other entities. So, no, it's given the wrong idea, and unfortunately it's completely misconstrued.
Right. Or it's the computer.
Well, yeah, or it's the computer or any technology. It could be connected with it, but it was originally in Greek script in capitals. So, incidentally, the number, I'm sure memory serves me correct here. The number only appears once in Revelation, but there are well over a dozen references to it in the book, one way or another.
To the number, okay.
Yeah, the number itself appears only once, but there are over a dozen references. So, we should note also that it is the two-horned beast, the second beast, that causes all to receive the mark. So there are two beasts. So it's the second beast that causes all to receive the mark. Now, the possibilities, as we said, and I'm getting to the interesting things here, the possibilities are indeed many if we try to determine numerical equivalents to the name. Ingenuity has connected the number, as we said, to almost everything. And there have been so many extreme solutions that have been proposed that I wish I just glossed over that and not even mentioned anything, but it's good to know how ridiculous things can become.
Yeah.
So it is often said by scholars that John, and this is true, and I agree with this, John was not trying to confuse or misdirect his readers with a riddle or with a pun, which cannot be solved. So I'm getting to who the beast might be and what it may mean.
And do you think, well, we'll find out, because you're going to tell us.
Yeah, eventually, yes, I'll explain how we might find out, although we may not find out the way that maybe you might think. So two reasons for this apparent secrecy, okay, are that it may not have proved beneficial for the recipients, as we said, of this letter, to have received a document which directly attacked the Roman Emperor or the Roman Empire. So John couldn't send off a letter to Asia Minor where the Emperor cult was thriving. The Emperor cult was where the Emperor was worshipped as God.
Right. They would have killed him.
Oh, not only, but he was already in exile in Patmos.
Yeah, that's right.
So John wrote the epistle. He was exiled in Patmos, in the Isle of Patmos. He wrote it around about 95 AD. He was actually exiled by Domitian, an emperor of the Flavian dynasty. So he was in exile, writing in Patmos.
And Patmos is a small Greek island.
In the Aegean Sea.
That's right.
In the Aegean Sea.
Hold on, MG. We're going to hit this break. We're going to come right back. Another hour to go with you. We'll get into 666. We'll get into your thoughts about who that might be. Lots coming up on Coast to Coast AM.